Thanks very much for calling today and taking a few minutes to talk to me. I wanted to start the conversation by discussing your critique of liberalism in the book, One Day Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This, starting with the idea of what you call fictions of moral convenience, you know, when it comes to genocide or atrocities that are being carried out, in this case by Israel against Palestine or Lebanon, but really by colonizers everywhere, that there are comforting narratives that are told to pacify people who know that what's happening is wrong but are not really willing to do anything about it. Is your frustration with that what drove you to write it? I mean, what was kind of the last straw for you?
As far as the last straw goes, I was waking up every day and seeing imagery and video and all manner of evidence of the worst things imaginable. And I was being told by the governments that represented me and continue to represent me and institutions that represent me of all kinds, academic, cultural, journalistic, you name it, that this was in fact a good and necessary thing. And that if I was opposed to it in any way, I was the bad guy, which is quite a crazy making state. One of the most interesting conversations that I've had about the book is that it is indeed sort of primarily a critique of this mode of liberalism that will quite happily and vigorously engage with acknowledging and regretting what has happened once it's safe enough to do so. And so I think a lot of the frustration that's in the book, and it's obviously a book that was written in a state of great anger, is not so much with the action of any one mode of thinking or sort of political operation. It's with this weird chasm between the principles as they are stated and the reality of what is acted out. You know, one of the things about living under Donald Trump, as I currently do in the United States, is that there's much less of a gap between the horrific things he says and the horrific things he does. Whereas previous Democratic administrations, you would have all manner of horror enacted, and then you would have someone in a nice suit come out and tell you how necessary and actually sort of peace-seeking this was. And again, that's crazy-making in an entirely different way. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing that a lot of the book is concerned with.
I mean, obviously there's an anger there that you mention. You know, it's like the insanity that is captured in novels like Catch-22 or some of Kurt Vonnegut's work. And you talk about watching a disjointed ballet of impossible reconciling when it comes to governments doing this dance that you're talking about, where they, on the one hand, are deeply regretful about what's occurring, but on the other hand, seem to be unable or unwilling to take action to stop it. How are you hoping that people will take this and change their behavior? What do you want liberals who are reading this to do about it?
I mean, it's a really interesting question, because one of the things I tend to say these days whenever I give a talk or when I find myself speaking to any kind of audience is that I have no interest in changing anybody's mind about anything anymore. And I understand that that can be seen as a sort of very nihilistic approach. And I think I have become somewhat more nihilistic over the last few years. You know, I've seen enough dead kids that it has changed my outlook slightly. I don't know how it could not. But I don't think that the root of this is a kind of nihilism. Rather, I don't feel that there is this obligation to tell people how to behave. People can act however they want. What I am trying to do with respect to myself, and again, I think everyone in some way needs to contend with this, is try to directly address the gap between who I say I am and who I really am. And so again, we come back to this notion of the vast majority of Western leaders talking about this, you know, hypothetical two-state solution, which again is sort of nonsense on its face, but using it as a means of describing this kind of hypothetical scenario that is directly contradicted by the actions of the government, the same government that is making these statements. And I think there's really only one way that you sort of get away with that, and that is when you fundamentally consider one group of people in any situation to be foundationally subhuman. Most everything that every Western government has said and done with respect to this conflict or whatever it is sort of described as makes perfect sense if you consider Palestinians to be foundationally subhuman.
So that concept, you know, you're talking about a concept of erasure where people are erased from our consciousness. And you talk about the heightened derangement of language for the purpose of sanitizing violence against them. Is your purpose, I guess, in writing this book, you know, I'm not suggesting it's just to cleanse yourself of that, but to articulate that issue and really try and bring it into people's awareness?
I mean, I think that there were a number of reasons why I wrote the book, and none of them is to say that, you know, it's a good book or it's worth anybody's time. Simply that these were the reasons this felt necessary for me to do.
Mm.
One of them is that it's the only thing I know how to do. I'm not good at anything else. I know how to write and I know how to do nothing else. And so when the world doesn't make sense to me, I tend to sit with that on the page. And again, I have no expectation that once I'm done sitting with it on the page that I'll have some new insight or catharsis or anything like that. It's simply the place I go when the world doesn't make sense to me. So that was one part of it. The other is that I felt like a lot of the things that I was seeing and a lot of the things I was being told to justify some of the most grotesque things that I've ever seen in my life was all going to be thrown down the memory hole eventually, and that it was going to be easier for all of us in a year, 2 years, 10 years' time to simply forget about this. And so there was an act of basic witness, which I think I describe in the book as being the most necessary and pathetic sort of mode of literature. So that was another reason for it. There is also a selfish component to this, and it would be disingenuous of me to pretend otherwise, which is at some point I wanted to be able to say that I had said something. You know, has this book changed anything? I doubt it. I have no idea. But at the very least, I can say that I wasn't completely quiet during the worst thing I've ever seen in my life, which, again, is a fundamentally selfish reason to do anything.
Obviously, the book is resonating with an audience. You have sold many copies. You've been on the New York Times bestsellers list. You have won the National Book Award in the U.S. But, you know, when you come back to those questions, they don't go away. So, you know, I'm conscious of this tension in the writing where you're raising these things and you don't necessarily, you know, it's not a prescriptive book in a sense that you're telling people what to do, but you do it in some places say that resistance is worth carrying out, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I should say that I think the reason the book has gotten the traction that it has, and it has gotten far more traction than it deserves, I think, is not necessarily the quality of the book, rather the fact that there's such an immense institutional suppression of any discussion around these topics,
mm-hmm.
that when something like this comes out, I think it tends to act like a bit of a steam vent for a lot of people. I mean, I was on the road for most of last year, including a pretty long stint in Canada, and at almost every event I did, somebody would come up afterwards and say, you know, this is the first place where I've been able to think through these issues without fear, right? Because if I talk about this at work, I might get fired. If I talk about this with my friends, they might not be my friends anymore. If I talk about this at a dinner party, I'm probably not getting invited to the next dinner party. And so I think there's been a kind of steam vent component to the book. And obviously, you know, the response has been almost completely polar in the sense that I've gotten a lot of, hey, this is great, and a lot of, hey, this is the worst thing I've ever read, which you can sort of expect for a book like this. That's not particularly surprising. But I think we're in this situation where a lot of people feel like they're losing their minds. They just have to live in the middle of what feels like a direct contradiction. And it's been around for a long time. You know, anyone who has been in the field of international human rights law, for example, will know full well that it is the attitude of many, many Western representatives that these rules and these courts and these war crimes legislations are for them, not for us.
You know, you're very right about the fact that it is a polarizing book. I mean, personally, I found it quite courageous and, yeah, just very honest in its explication of what is happening before our eyes. Irina Velitskaya wrote in February in the Times of Israel, after your book won the National Book Award in the U.S., very dismissively that liberals love to be lectured about how morally deficient they are and hypocritical they are. They eat it up. They just never do anything about it. And so, you know, You mentioned earlier that you're feeling a little more nihilistic about things, maybe, but, you know, it seems like there's a driving force in this. In exposing the issue, you are hoping that people will do something about it rather than just have liberals kind of conveniently hold your book and say, look, he's exposing this horror. We need to just sit in our castigation here about it and be self-flagellating. I'm assuming that that's not your hope.
It's a really good question. A few weeks ago, I was having lunch with a friend of mine who had been on the first Gaza flotillas, and he had ended up in an Israeli prison before he got out and returned to the U.S. And we were talking about this idea of why it always seems like trying to create positive change in a society, particularly positive structural or institutional change, feels like such an uphill climb and feels so glacial almost all of the time. And I think the closest I can come to in terms of trying to describe it is that you effectively have this house, and it's an incredibly spacious and luxurious house, and it has all of the amenities, and everyone knows how everything in the house works and what you need to do to get a bigger room in the house and so on and so forth. And then you got a few people outside building a shack because they see that in this very nice house, there are termites in the foundations. And they're trying to convince people to come over and help them build this shack because eventually the shack will get into, you know, become something bigger and we'll have enough room for us all and so on and so forth. And anyway, no matter how pretty this other house looks, there's termites in the foundations. It's coming down at some point. And that's a really difficult sales pitch, I think. Because until the day the beams come crashing down, it's going to be far more comfortable for a lot of people to live in that nice house. And that's effectively, I think, where we end up right now, where we have institutions that are based on endless theft. I mean, capitalism in whatever stage we're living under right now is an endlessly expanding form of being in the world. Colonialism has always been a mode of endless theft. And then you have a few folks trying to build something else and with very limited resources. And it does not seem appealing to a lot of other people because, you know, why? Why would I want to be a part of this? And the answer is, you know, because this other system is burning up our planet and using up all of our resources and eventually will lead to ruin. Well, eventually we'll all be dead. So I think that's one of the reasons we end up in this situation where progress feels so difficult and why someone like me is so finds the prospect of cynicism or even nihilism more appealing than he should on most days. But I also see the work that is being done to build solidarity and build institutions from the ground up. I mean, here in Portland, we have members of city council who have been elected who are willing to speak up on this issue. Even that is a massive achievement. We have people building their own, you know, obviously I live in the world of sort of literary institutions, and there are people building their own literary institutions from the ground up. Do they have the resources of the New York Times? No. But it's something, right? It's someone trying to build this shack with the hopes that it'll keep getting better and that when we're done, whatever it is, it's not going to have termites in the foundations. But that's a hard sell for most people. And so that's my way of trying to think through it. And, you know, it's not the most hopeful way of putting it, but I think the fact that people are doing the work despite these odds and despite this great asymmetry is something that is incredibly hopeful.
Omar, I'd like to thank you first for writing the book and second for taking a few minutes to chat with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.